I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Okay, so before we get started with this episode, I just want to give you a bit of a heads up, I guess a bit of a trigger warning, that this episode will be exploring transitioning, medically transitioning if you're a trans person, maybe some of the repercussions associated with that, some of the negative press and the negative side effects of that. If any of that is triggering at all, please feel free to stop listening at any point and come back to it. It is totally okay. You just do things on your own time. So with that in mind, let's get started with the episode. This is the original intersectional feminist podcast that aims to subvert and challenge the norm by providing a platform to voices, stories, and narratives ignored by the mainstream. For this series of episodes, we're exploring reproductive health, and in true Kick in the Kyriarchy form, we've got an amazing selection of individuals to tell their story. So far, we've covered abortion both in the 60s and what getting an abortion looks like in the UK today. We spoke to Dr. Verity about the impact that funding cuts and that buzzword austerity is having on our sexual health services. This week, we're focusing on trans reproductive healthcare. And I feel like I need to do a bit of a disclaimer here. It's really important to point out that this conversation and topic by no means is reducing trans people to the sum of their parts. And I know that sometimes conversations surrounding trans people can often just focus on their physical bodies, and this is not about that. When we talk about looking after our reproductive healthcare and the education around it, the conversation tends to revolve around the experience of cisgendered men and women. And when I think back about my own experience at school, I never learned anything about what trans people could do to manage and look after their sexual healthcare or what concerns they might have, which is so ridiculous when you consider the impact that medically transitioning could have on your reproductive system and then the financial cost on top of that. I mean, this is why it's so important just to include LGBTQ plus sex education in schools in general, but that is a completely different episode, I guess. Anyway, this isn't for me to tell you about, because let's face it, I have absolutely no authority on the matter, but I'm trying to be the best ally that I can, and sometimes that means listening to other experiences that aren't your own. So with that in mind, let's meet my next guest, Kate.
Okay, hi, I'm Kate. I'm a 40-something Asian mixed race, introverted, queer, trans woman. And that's really cool, actually. It's really nice to introduce myself like this. So many people ask me to introduce myself by what I do and not by who I am. So thank you for asking me to do it this way.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you so much for coming on this episode. So I guess my first question is, what is your journey so far? What's your experience?
The reason I kind of got into sexual health in the first place was actually during my time as a medical student. I transitioned as a medical student, and it was a tough time. I remember coming into the medical school, and I wanted to make a new start. I wanted to, be my own person, and I didn't want to have the kind of the baggage of my past coming along with me. But inevitably, that stuff all kind of ends up catching up, and I did have a really hard time. And the medical school assigned a personal tutor to me, and they, at that time, this was in the 90s, they really didn't do a lot of that. But, you know, if I had a bad day, if somebody said something horrible to me, if I got misgendered, then I would just go along to her, I'd knock on her door, and she'd always be there to have a chat to me and make a cup of tea. And, you know, even when I was like down in the sort of pits of depression, she just helped me through. And she was a sexual health doctor. It kind of like sparked my interest in the profession. And I could see someone who I really kind of, I aspired to be someone like her, someone who was caring and could give the time for a student like me and for her patients. And that's kind of what like got me really interested in it. You know, I have to say, like after that time, I spent a lot of my sort of working life trying to get away from that whole thing about being trans. I had, I guess, a lot of shame about it, and that sort of feeling that, I was a bit of an imposter if I was kind of, you know, being open and out about it. And it was quite a few years later, quite a long time later, that, you know, I remember seeing like an email go around at work about a colleague who was transitioning at that time. And he and I are actually really good friends now. We kind of know each other at the time, but I didn't know him then. He was coming out. He was just sort of announcing that this was going to happen. He was coming back to work and he was going to change his name, change, you know, his pronouns, and the, you know, just trying to be trying to explain what the transition meant to him. And I remember thinking, you know, maybe I ought to reach out to him and just, you know, just kind of like say, hey, hi, there's, you know, if you need to have a chat to someone, if you need a sort of you know, friendly ear to listen to, then you know, I'm here. And I thought long and hard about it, and I decided not to in the end. I just didn't feel like I was in the right place to do that. And then later I heard that he'd had a really, really tough time. And, you know, he could really have done with a friend around at that time. And it just kind of hit me at that point. It was like, I wouldn't say it's a bit cliche, isn't it? It's that sort of road to Damascus moment, but it's about as close as I can get to that. And it kind of made me think that, you know, I have those experiences of my own life and what it meant to go through being a trans person working in the NHS, and I have that skills and those abilities to be able to help other people. And if I don't do that, then perhaps I'm wasting that opportunity. And so it happened around about that time that one of my colleagues who actually knew me from medical school, he came up to me, we worked together, and we were really, really good friends. And he said that it was a group of trans people within Brighton at that time had come to us in the clinic and said, you know, we really want to set up a sexual health service that's like more appropriate to the needs of trans people. My colleague came up to me and said, Kate, would you like to do this? And I really thought that really hard at that time. And I thought, oh my God. And then I thought, what happened? They kind of happened around about the same time. It happened with a guy at work, and I hadn't said anything at the time. And I said, okay, this is clearly a sign of some sort. You know, I'm not religious or superstitious or anything like that at all, but this is clearly a sign. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And that's how we founded Clinic T. You know, a lot of people say, oh, okay, it's great you started this clinic. It's like, no, it wasn't me at all. I didn't start it. I was actually quite sort of reluctant to get involved at the beginning. It was actually other people. It was the community. It was people in the city saying that, you know, we really need a service that that looks after us as trans and gender diverse people, and, you know, puts us sort of, you know, front and center, and takes into consideration, you know, what our healthcare needs are. And so, yeah, it's grown from there.
Amazing. Yeah. So you mentioned Clinic T, and it's a service that is, as you said, specializing and putting trans and gender diverse people at the forefront. Why is a service like that needed?
There's a lot of reasons why it's needed. A lot of reasons. You know, if you look at some of the research, let's just start at that level to start off with. You know, we had done a study in Brighton, you know, quite a few years before that, showing that the trans people weren't coming to sexual health services. And when we asked why, people said, you know, the service just isn't appropriate to our needs. And people had bad experiences. You know, people had been, you know, even things like being misgendered on the phone, just booking an appointment, that really does put you off. and you know, the services were really, you know, binary identified, you know, at that time. Like a lot of places now, even now, you know, that we had, like, you know, separate male and female waiting rooms. Everything was just very, very binary. You know?
Wow.
Yeah, we've changed. Well, that's changed now. You know, and I'd encourage other clinics to you know, come and have a talk to us if, you know, you really want to look at how you can change your you know, the infrastructure to make it more welcoming. But you know, that, so yeah, on a kind of, you know, on a sort of research level, it's you know, we found that that's important. And that study was like from 2008, and if you look at a recent study that was done looking at the same question, it was done amongst 500 odd trans people within the UK. It's seen the same kind of rates. You know, more than half of the people who were interviewed hadn't had a sexual health screen done. You know, about, you know, nearly 60% of people never had an HIV test done in the past. And I think that, you know, it's a whole group of people that are missing out because they just don't feel able to go to the service. And I think on a more personal level, you know, it's quite difficult as a trans person to try to explain to a clinician who may have no idea about what it's like to be trans, you know, about what that feeling is actually really like.
Yeah.
You know, that feeling of dysphoria, it's really hard to explain. I guess, I don't know who, you know, who came up with this analogy, but, you know, I'd love to credit them. I can't remember who it was, but I remember I'm saying it's like trying to explain dysphoria. It's like trying to explain grief to someone who's never felt it before. You can explain it on kind of one level. You can say it's that feeling of sadness, it's that feeling of loss, but it doesn't really get across that really deep kind of visceral feeling about what it's like. And being, you know, feeling dysphoria is kind of, it's kind of like that. You can't really, it's really hard to explain to someone else what that's genuinely like. You know, for me, that feeling of, it doesn't really go away. You know, going through the medical transition, it kind of, I guess to extend that analogy, it kind of gave me, you know, taught me how to cry, I suppose, in some respects, it, you know, in a sort of figurative kind of way. It allowed me that release to be able to express grief, but express my dysphoria in that way. So it didn't ever make it go away. It just gave me a way of being able to deal with it. And I think that's true for so many trans people, you know, whether they're at the beginning of their transition or whether it's something that's just well into their past and it's part, you know, part of their history. Dysphoria never exactly goes away. And trying to, you know, explain that to clinicians when they've never really understood or find it really hard to understand, was, I think, you know, part of the real driving reason why we really wanted to build that service so that we could we could get that understanding into my colleagues, and we could really, just you know, be on the same level as the people that we were looking after.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about my own experience of going to the doctors, and it's a scary one. Couple that with potentially being misgendered, of not being understood, that feeling of dysphoria. I can't even begin to relate to it. I can totally understand how that can be quite an unsettling and daunting experience. I'm also really conscious of not medicalizing the trans experience.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really conscious of that. But then in equal measure, I feel like we live in a society that really does. I don't know. What's your take on
Yeah, I think society does probably unfairly and unnecessarily over medicalizes that. But you know, on the one hand, you know, as healthcare professionals, you know, people are coming to us for medical advice.
Right. True.
And you got to take into account that sort of trans part of somebody's life is kind of that, it's part of their identity, but it doesn't necessarily have to impact on the medical care that they get. You know, if you go to your doctor for some whatever reason, it doesn't necessarily have to be something that's related to being trans at all.
Right.
But you know, in this situation, sometimes when it comes to sexual health or reproductive health, often those things are kind of, you know, really tightly intertwined. And sadly, what tends to happen is that there are, you know, that many clinicians just, you know, don't have that knowledge or that training to be able to understand how those, you know, how that experience of being trans or being gender diverse impacts on someone's sexual health and someone's reproductive health. You know, it can be something as, you know, as critical as the, you know, hormone treatment affecting somebody's fertility, or it can be, you know, something like, you know, somebody's identity affecting their sexuality, or it can be just, you know, their people's experience of negotiating safe sex or, you know, relationships and how that relates to their gender. It can be really, you know, multifaceted. And so, yeah, you're right. We don't want to over-medicalize things, but sometimes we can't always get away from that need to have that medical knowledge as well.
Right. I'm really conscious of the fact that our healthcare, for example, is very expensive in the States, whereas in the UK we have the NHS. So does that make accessing healthcare for trans people any easier? Like, how straightforward is it to access?
Yeah, it does. I think you can't really underestimate this, how important the NHS is. And the fact that we have this network of sexual health clinics, and, you know, I'm talking more broadly, not just about trans people here. Yeah. If we look at you know, rates of ill health in the US, if you look like broadly across the whole population, actually the US isn't doing particularly well at all. It has really great healthcare if you can afford it, yeah, but loads of people can't, and so people fall through the gaps. And that ability for you know, us living here in the UK to be able to go and freely access you know, sexual health care. You know, you don't need an appointment, and oftentimes you just pitch up at a clinic. You don't pay for the prescriptions that you're given there. You know, you will get to see someone that, you know, often that day, or very close to it if you're booking an appointment. You know, you just don't get that, you know, elsewhere. And I think, and that's particularly true if you look at the healthcare of trans people, that, you know, as I said, you know, there are barriers towards that. But, you know, in other parts of the world, those barriers are really absolute. The rates of HIV in some parts of the world, particularly amongst trans women, are huge. You know, if you look at studies, you can see that, you know, in say India, for example, or parts of South America, you know, you're seeing maybe sort of, you know, 40%, you know, 30% of people who are trans are HIV positive as well. And that's largely due to people being stigmatized, being marginalized, not having access to healthcare, being denied access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. You know, people, you know, if they're facing sexual violence, they can't access the help that they need. People living in poverty, and, you know, they are forced into not making a choice, but having to forced into sex work, because that's the only way that they can make a living, and often have to work in an unsafe environment. And so, you know, many of those factors just don't exist here in the UK, because we have a health service that gives all of us, irrespective of our gender, that access to really, really good, high quality healthcare. Mm. You know, and I'm proud to work in the NHS because of that. I think it's a wonderful institution. You know, I think it's something that we need to cherish and to, you know, and to support.
If you want to think about your fertility or your reproductive health, what's the system like to navigate?
That's where sometimes the things don't work as well as they could do, and that's the difficulty. For a trans person accessing fertility care, it can feel like a you know, a bit like a minefield, really. It's care varies from place to place, so there's a bit of a postcode lottery. If you're trying to access something like gamete storage, so that's storage of sperm or eggs to preserve your fertility, then getting that funded through the NHS really varies depending on where you live. Now, we hope that that's going to change. At the moment, there's a legal case going through, and I hope, you know, by the time this podcast airs, that actually there is going to be a positive resolution to that. I can't really speak very much about that at the moment because it's still subject to a legal case. But, you know, we are optimistic that there's going to be a positive change there. You know, even if you look at, you know, things like maternity service, for example, They are, you know, it's great that we have free maternity care. You know, we take that for granted here in the UK. But, you know, imagine as a transmasculine person going to navigate pregnancy care services, it can feel like a very alien environment. Mm. You know, I'm just going to give them a quick plug to you know, two amazing midwives that I work with, you know, in Brighton, and they have done the most amazing things to make their service gender inclusive. And I think that, you know, around, if you look around the NHS, there's little pockets of, you know, really, really great practice. It's just a matter of trying to find them.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You mentioned gamete storage. Mm. Is it a concern, you know, when you decide if you want to medically transition? Is it a concern to think about your fertility?
It is a really important thing to consider. It's a really important thing to consider. It's not an inevitability that if you start medical transition or if you take hormones that you will inevitably become infertile. I think that's something that's really important to bear in mind. You know, a lot of my work is actually talking about contraception. So in terms of fertility, inevitably, if you are taking hormone therapy, you will have a decline in infertility. And obviously, if you then go on to have surgery, then you know that loss of fertility will be permanent. Mm. And you know, for someone, particularly if they're young, you know, you might be thinking of having a family. It's not the first thing that comes to mind. You know, particularly when you're trying to negotiate the complexities of transition, it's often something that doesn't sort of come to the forefront. But then, you know, if I've talked about it, or you know, my colleagues working in gender identity have talked about it, then you've got the next sort of hurdle to think, well, if we can't access it on the NHS, then how am I going to afford to get this paid for privately? And then it does become a you know, there's an issue there of you know, a huge barrier to being able to get that care that you really need. For people are then having to make a choice about, you know, is it my transition or my fertility? And that's a horrible, horrible place to put anybody in.
Right. I feel like in the news, I always see some sort of controversy surrounding trans kids. And I was reading an article today, actually, about the ability or the option to give children, is it hormone blockers? Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about, I guess, being a trans child and being put on hormone blockers? Like, will this affect fertility? Is that something to take into consideration?
It is something to take into consideration, yes. You know, I just want to make clear, the scope of my practice is in adults, and
I don't
look after children, but it is, it's part of the medical transition pathway for children to have essentially hormone blocking medication, which just puts puberty on pause.
Right.
And probably the hardest part, I think, for many trans people is that process of puberty. You know, that understanding that, you know, if you come to that understanding of you know, knowing that your gender isn't, you know, doesn't match up with your body, then seeing your body change in this very essentially the wrong way for you is a very distressing experience to go through. And so the idea of blockers is just to put that on hold. But it does have an effect on fertility. Yes, it inevitably does. It's something that is discussed with children and young people as they're going through transition. But as I said before, it's not always the first thing on your mind. If you're a young teenager, thinking about, oh, how do I preserve my fertility? What happens if I want to have a family in the future? Yeah. Those aren't kind of questions that are like foremost in your mind.
And so you mentioned that you also work in contraception. What does that world look like for trans people navigating that?
At the moment, if you look at how the information about contraception or reproductive health more generally is couched, it's very cis normative, it's very heteronormative, and so as a young queer person, as a young trans person, just trying to see how do I fit in all of this is really difficult. I remember having a look through our information leaflets about the various different types of contraception out there, and just thinking, these are so gendered, and these are really binary. They talk about girls, they talk about women. But if you're a transmasculine person, and we're trying to explain contraception and say, well, here's a booklet, go and have a think about it. We've had a bit of a discussion, and you look through this, and you just think, this doesn't really speak to me. It doesn't answer the questions that I need to know. And in fact, it actually can be a little bit counterproductive. You're almost like you're reading about somebody else. You're not reading about something that is relevant. And so it's something that we want to change. There's a couple of colleagues of mine are working in the clinic, and we've done some work to. And ask people who come into the clinic, ask people in the community about what information do they need, what are the questions that are relevant, how would they like to see us present this information, how can you write these better, and I think that is that across the board, I think that's really important. It's part of that thing I was talking about earlier about trying to make healthcare for trans people like more appropriate to their needs and putting people right up at the front.
Right. In your work, do you ever work with sex workers, trans sex workers? Mm-hmm. Are there specific needs that we should be thinking about when it comes to trans sex workers when we're thinking about, I guess, contraception?
So, yeah, I do look after quite a lot of people who are sex working in all sorts of different ways. And I think you've got to think that sex working is, there isn't a sort of stereotype of what someone who is a sex worker is, it's just trying to be responsive to exactly what that person's needs are. But yeah, it's one of those things that often isn't really talked about. And when we talk about trans people who are sex workers, often there's this kind of feeling that somebody is being victimized or sort of pushed into it, whereas often the people that I'm seeing are people who've made that choice and it's a positive choice for their own lives, that that's what they want to do. And for us as healthcare professionals, we are there not to make like moral judgments about this is a good thing or a bad thing, but it's just to say, we want you to do this in a way that is safe and looks after your sexual health. And there are things we can do, for example, the issue of PrEP or pre-exposure prophylaxis is something that, is particularly relevant and pertinent at this time. We are in an era now where we're starting to see here in the UK, a downturn in the number of new HIV diagnoses. And that's fantastic. PrEP is one part of that. It's also about, we're doing more testing. People who are diagnosed positive have started on treatment earlier. But PrEP is a really key part of that that downturn in new HIV diagnoses. And it's something that a lot of times, particularly trans people, aren't really aware of. you know, they might have heard a little bit about it. A lot of the campaigns and the literature and the advertising out there is aimed at cisgendered gay men, and obviously that's great that there is that information out there, and that group of people, you know, are very sort of, you know, proactive about coming and talk to us about PrEP. Yeah. But, you know, often we're seeing people who are trans people, who are sex workers of, you know, any gender, who just aren't aware that this is something that might actually be beneficial for them. So that's definitely one side of things. You know, as I was saying before, you know, just being trans, being on hormone therapy doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to be at risk of pregnancy if that's the you know, if physically you're able to do that. It's about really trying to understand from somebody else's point of view about what healthcare means to them, how they want to access it. Because I think if you ask people, it's very rare that someone will say, you know, they don't ever want to access healthcare at all. Some people do, but most people don't. And it's just a matter of finding out what is the best way for that person. And sometimes, you know, it can be something they might not have thought of, and we can suggest it. Other times, you know, they've got a very clear idea about what works best. So, you know, just a matter of asking and finding out.
Yeah, absolutely. I just came across today, actually, is forced sterilisation of trans people a thing? I read somewhere that it was in the US. Is it a thing in the UK, or is it a thing?
So it's not a thing in the UK. So let me make it clear. So the whole, it's a really important issue to talk about, and thank you for bringing it up, because in parts of the world, legal recognition of someone's gender identity is contingent upon them undergoing some kind of procedure that results in sterilisation. So, and to be honest with you, that is absolutely abhorrent. That's a horrible situation, you know, morally repugnant. And it's just not representative of real lives for, you know, for people who are trans. And rightly so, the United Nations has condemned this. The European Court of Human Rights has declared this illegal. And yet, even after that, you know, there's about, I think it's 14 countries in Europe. You know, Europe has a geographical landmass rather than the EU, that still insist on sterilisation as part of the requirement for legal gender recognition. There was an article really recently about the situation in Japan. Yeah. You think, yeah, you might have seen this, and this came from a report by Human Rights Watch, and they, you know, the situation there for trans people is really, really dire. I mean, it's just, you know, to have a legal recognition of your gender. You need firstly a medical diagnosis, which is still in over there considered to be a mental health diagnosis. You need to be unmarried. You need to not have any children under the age of 20, and you need to have undergone a medical procedure that essentially renders you sterile and remodels your genitalia according to the gender that you're presenting in. So you need to have essentially a medical and surgical transition, and to not either have children or to be able to conceive children in the future. And I think that is just, I don't have words to describe it. That is just horrific. Mm. You know, and we're very fortunate that, you know, the Gender Recognition Act here in the UK, it does need updating. It does need, bringing into the modern age. But at least we never stipulated that as part of the requirement for legal gender recognition. And even if you look at, you know, if you look at Sweden, you know, they were one of the first countries to bring in legal gender recognition. I think it was back in the 70s, and at that time they did insist on sterilisation as part of that process, and that was changed in 2013. And Sweden's paid compensation to the trans people who were, or they've offered trans compensation to the trans people who were affected by this. And I think that's really what needs to happen. I mean, you know, ideally it shouldn't be there at all, but in countries where that has happened, that needs to change, and it needs to change now.
Yeah. I can't even begin to imagine what that must feel like for trans people living under that and having to go through that.
It is. You're right. Terrifying, I think, is the right word. It's just immoral, really.
Yeah.
To have to, you know, insist on that, and it is born out of the sense of moral panic, really, isn't it? There is no scientific justification or evidence behind this, you know, and it's just seeing, you know, us as trans people as being, you know, somehow, you know, a second class citizen that we, you know, we can't have, you know, that right or that autonomy, you know, over our own reproductive health.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just find it horrible and just completely unacceptable.
Yeah, it's like something out of like Handmaid's Tale, you know, which I know is the funny thing with Handmaid's Tale is that in theory everything has already happened. You know, she didn't include anything in that book that hadn't happened. And so, how can we be better allies to trans people, specifically concerning their sexual health, their reproductive health, and maybe to the doctors, to the NHS, our local services? How can we?
I think the fact that we're talking about this now is actually brilliant, because I think that, you know, we need to actually get a discussion going and have people kind of, you know, more clued up and more aware. And I think that's particularly true of people working in the healthcare sector. Find ways of being able to talk to your local community, talk to trans people who are using your services, and to say, well, is there anything we can do better? You know, are there people out there who just don't feel they want to come to the service? Are we missing out on a group of people? And that's a great way to be, you know, to be an ally. If you are, you know, a healthcare provider yourself, you know, don't live in ignorance. There's information out there. We're trying to provide more information. We're trying to do more training. We're trying to talk to more people. You know, don't just assume that you can wing it when it comes to looking after trans people, you know, because there's stuff out there that is really important to understand and to know about, and a lot of that it will only come by talking to people who actually are living, who are trans and who are living with it.
Final question. What are you working on? Anything you're working on? How can we find you? How can we support you? Okay. The platform is yours.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. So to find me, if you want to talk to me, Twitter's probably the easiest way to do it. Just at Kate Nambier on Twitter. I am a trustee of a charity called the Claire Project. It's a peer support charity for trans people in Brighton. And I'm really proud to be part of that charity. And we do some amazing things to help people through their transition process, you know, before and after that. The charity's growing. We're doing more things to be able to reach out to our community. I'm really proud to be working for them. So, you know, do look us up if you're ever in Brighton, you know, have a regular drop-in. And it's a great place to be able to come and meet other trans folk and just to share some social space and time together. And, yeah, it's
amazing.
Really cool.
What's the name again?
The Claire Project.
The Claire Project. Amazing. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For having a chat and for giving up your time, you know, intellectual and emotional labour. I really appreciate that. So, thank you. Thank you so much to Kate for being my guest on this podcast all about reproductive healthcare in the trans community. I'm so grateful to her. And one of the things that I found when I was listening to Kate was to question the binary in society, going to a space, and an important space like a hospital. And if you were a gender non-conforming person or a trans person or a non-binary person and feeling uncomfortable. So I thought that was a really interesting point. And I think that it's something that I'm going to go away with and think about, and maybe you will too, about questioning the binary in society and thinking about the spaces that you occupy, whether that's, you know, your work or your gym or a hospital that you go to. would a trans, non-binary, gender non-conforming person feel comfortable in that space? One of a myriad of ways that cisgendered people could be allies to trans people is about thinking about the spaces that we occupy. If you've listened to this episode and you're a trans person and you want more information about your sexual health, your reproductive health, there are some amazing practices out there. Obviously, Kate's Clinic T, which is in the Brighton and Hove area, but there's also another one called Clinic Q, and then the Terence Higgins Trust does a lot of work with trans men and women. So if that's something that you're interested in, please reach out to them. Thank you so much for listening. Please rate, review, subscribe to the podcast. It really helps so much. You can get in touch. You can drop me an email, kickinthekyriarchy@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter @kickkyriarchy. Or you should go follow our brand new Instagram account @kickinthekyriarchy, where it's got all our illustrations currently and retrospectively and other amazing Kick in the Kyriarchy intersectional feminist content vibes. Next week we will be chatting to Hayden Cross, who is the first trans man in the UK to give birth, which follows on nicely from our conversation this week with Kate. So yeah, I'm super excited for you to hear that. I can't wait. See you next time.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.